You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Kimberly Brown. Normally here, I would have a hook, or I would give you a hint about the topic, or I would just tell you directly what the main conversation was going to be about. Instead, I'm going to kick this off with a question, which honestly may not even make any sense, but let's go with it here, okay? What do physics, English, and psychoanalysis have in common? Can you think of anything? It's like I'm playing with you that game, that online game Connections, where you try and bring the tiles together that have a connection. Or in my family, a long time ago, we used to actually play a board game that's called Tribond. And that was also the objective. You would get these terms and try and guess or figure out what the connection was. So think about that. Kimberly and I talk about a time in her life when she made a career shift that was really pretty big, big shift. And she shares what brought her to that point. What was going on in her life, what she was thinking about, and then how she made the decision to make that shift. And then, very interestingly, what she did afterwards, which turned out to be her lifelong passion, at least so far. I think that you're going to love this conversation, and I'm excited to share it with you. So let's do it. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Kimberly Brown, are you ready for a fun chat?
I am indeed, Amy, and I'm really glad to be here.
Oh, that's amazing. All right, I start all of my conversations with the exact same question. What part of the world do you call home?
Well, I am in New York, and right now I'm in New York City, although I am spending much more time and moving upstate New York.
Oh, very nice to get out of the city. To get out of the city, I get it. Very good. What part of upstate do you like?
We stay in Troy, New York, which is up in the Capital Region.
If right
anyone
near
knows New York,
yeah.
near Albany and that
home
area.
Home of Rensselaer, right?
Yes, we're right near there, around the block from Rensselaer Polytechnic. Yeah.
There you go. There you go. I grew up in New York, so that's how I know the names of some of the towns. Although, as a child, I once was asked on an actual school test, what is the capital of New York? And I said Manhattan. So, you know, I failed. Got that one wrong.
Well, if you ask any New Yorker, New York City person, we would tell you that is true. You should have gotten an A on that one.
My father did not agree. He was like, let's get you a map and let's review. All right, next warm-up question. This is going to come out shortly before February to end of January, I think. So this is about the Valentine's themey kind of stuff. Do you as a person enjoy getting fresh cut flowers as a present? And if you do, what is your favorite flower?
Oh, wow. Well, I do. It is an emphatic yes. I love getting flowers. And I suppose, I mean, any flower you would give me, Amy, I'd be thrilled. Just want to make sure everybody knows that. You can send me any flower. But I suppose my favorite would be peonies and ranunculus and maybe daisies.
Ooh, very nice. Very, very nice. I don't know what the middle one was. I don't know. I think I know that flower. I have to check it out.
They look like little buds and they have a very sort of tight bloom.
Okay.
Ranunculus. They're little ones.
That's
pretty.
A fun word, ranuncula. Okay. All right. Very good. Today, we're not talking about flowers, although that is a wonderful conversation. We're talking about a pretty significant career change that you made in your 30s, I think. So are you ready to chat about that today?
I am. Yeah,
all
I'm
right.
glad to.
Very good. So I think that what was going on, and you can correct this and tell me the correct details if I get it wrong. I think you were studying clinical psychology is where I think you might have been doing. So let me know if that's not right. And then let's talk a little bit about where you were in that academic path and how long you had already been invested in that study course.
Yeah, what I was doing was training to be a psychoanalyst.
Okay.
And psychoanalysis training is done in private institutes. It requires, in general, that you have some sort of graduate degree. And I had a master's degree in English. And then in my 30s, this was not, there were a lot of life changes that happened to me. I lived in New York during 9/11, and I had a really wonderful psychotherapist that had helped me so much when I was young, around 30. And so it just seemed like, oh, and I worked in human resources. That's what I was doing for a living. And it felt like, well, I'd really like to use everything I've learned from my therapist and from life, and perhaps also learn to work with people and support them, And so I enrolled in a course in a psychoanalytic institute here in New York City. It was called Washington Square Institute. It's no longer in existence. And in general, it takes around between 4 and 6 years to complete the psychoanalytic program. It requires classes. It also requires that you see patients under, I had a supervisor to discuss my cases. And it required that I underwent psychoanalysis with a psychoanalyst. So it was very intense. And I was in the program for about 4 years, maybe a little longer, when I realized it was not for me.
So this is really interesting. This is an unexpected turn of the path because I did not realize, I didn't know that this was even an option. So your undergraduate and your first graduate, so English was your graduate work. What did you, if I had met you when you were a kid before, like a middle school, and asked you what did you want to be when you grew up, what would you say? What
I
would you have
probably would have
said?
said a writer. Yeah, I
A
would have said a
writer.
writer.
Okay. All right. So, master's in English. Was your undergrad also in English?
It was actually in physics.
Physics. Oh my gosh, you've been all over the place. Good heavens. Okay, so physics. What did you think you were going to do with that?
Well, then I really just studied it because I was interested, and certain things had come very easy to me, like
Okay.
writing, like the humanities, like reading. I always would get A's. It was, just I was inclined that way. But math and the sciences, I was less inclined that way. And I thought, well, I'm gonna try something harder for me that I'm interested in, to see if I can do it and to see what it would be like. And it was really hard, and it was also very humbling in the best way to not be that person that was always like, in the top smarties in the class. I really needed to ask for a lot of help, and I had to find people to study with. So it was an interesting endeavor, but I knew I wasn't going to be a physicist.
Right. Well, that's, so physics is a very specific thing. So with a physics degree, you can be a physics teacher, you can be an engineer, you can build bombs, you could, like those, that kind of thing. But and then to go from that to a master's in English, that's a dramatic shift. So you end up in the workplace working in a corporate environment in HR. And did you like your job?
I liked my job a lot. I worked in a very hectic, small, boutique marketing firm. It was
Okay.
very like the stereotype, or like you might see on an old television program of, kind of a quirky and demanding yet interesting boss,
Okay.
and very smart people. I really liked it. It was very dynamic. Also, often in smaller companies, you don't get pigeonholed quite as much. So, although ostensibly I was HR, I was involved with lots of things, and I really liked that. And what I liked about my job was, and what I've always been inclined toward, is working with people, being,
Okay.
talking to them, listening to them. It's it, people always interest me. And so that was a big part of my job, and I really did enjoy it. I lived in Manhattan at the time, and I was younger. It was a nice time, except I always felt like I hadn't found my way yet. I
Okay.
liked it. It was a job, but it never felt, Amy, like a career.
All right. So you didn't think that you were going to spend, it was not your forever job working for this
Correct.
startup. I like the way you say you don't get pigeonholed in the startup. The other way to say that is that there's so few people working in the company that everybody has to do everything. And
Yes.
it's definitely an energy that not everybody likes.
Yes.
But some people really blossom in the startup vibe. So you are pursuing, how do you talk, walk me through how you make the decision to sign up for this psychoanalyst certification, this program? Like, what was going on in your mind that was drawing you to that and the work that would go with it?
Yeah. So this would have been in around 2003-ish, somewhere around there. And if you lived, well, anyone in the US was affected by 9/11,
Yes.
certainly. But if you lived in the city, it was something that, even if you didn't know it, was affecting you for a long time. And as I look back on that time, Amy, I can see not only me, but a lot of people I knew made big life decisions in the next few years after
Oh my
that.
God, everybody
Got
I knew
married, got
moved, yeah,
divorced,
moved
right?
out of the city.
Moved.
Everybody moved out of the city.
Yes.
A bunch of people changed careers. Even if they just moved to New Jersey, it was like move from the city over to New Jersey. Yeah, big changes. One of my family members was living in the village, so it was a dramatic impact, right? You were dramatically
Yeah.
impacted. They overcorrected slightly, and they moved to Princeton, Cranberry, New Jersey, which is not
Oh,
even
wow.
as big as Princeton.
Yep.
So they went from living in the biggest city in the United, this huge, enormous city, vibrant city, to this teeny tiny, adorable postage stamp town. And they went from being lifelong renters to owners of a historic house. Completely, their life was upside down, and it was 10 years of hilarity until they got back to the city, because they were all in, and they were almost instantaneously miserable with their decision. But it was so overcorrection, just exactly like you're saying. They did not realize the impact of living through that and
Yeah,
how it happened.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
So I
that's what was
interrupted you. I
unfolding. No,
apologize.
you didn't at all, Amy, because I share your, who, did you say there's your brother?
Is my
Your
brother-in-law and his wife, yeah.
brother-in-law. Yeah. I know those people and I felt that too, And so I wasn't quite understanding that was operating, but that was operating. And I just felt like I have to do something. I felt kind of an urgency. Am I going to stay here and work in HR forever? I don't love it. Do I want to pursue this writing, that I thought I wanted to do? And I had a psychoanalyst from the time I was probably, I don't know, my mid to late 20s till my early 30s, like 3 or 4 years. And she kind of saved my life, Amy. I had a
Okay.
really difficult background and as a young adult was very insecure and had a lot of panic attacks and was very rough on myself. Just thought, well, I should just, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? Why can't I just be okay? And she really helped me and she really kind of supported me to bring a little understanding and softness to myself. So I felt really grateful to her.
Okay.
And she inspired me,
Yeah.
and so that was a big reason too. I wanted to be like her.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is you were at a point in your life where there was going to be a change. You weren't fully fulfilled where you were, and you were searching for the next great thing that you would do, and you had this person in your life that was a representation of what you thought you maybe could step into. And so you go back to school. You go back to school. Were you
Yeah.
working at the same time that you were
I
taking these
was.
classes?
I was
Okay.
working at the same time, and I was very lucky that the owner of the company was she had been in a psychoanalysis for years and years, like decades, and she was really supportive of me. I would go at lunch to a class or really supportive of me being able to work and train as well. So I was doing both. And at first, like any new endeavor, it was interesting, it was exciting, and I really like school. You know, when you said just a moment ago, you said, okay, you decided to go back to school. For me, that was always sort of the default. I don't know what to do. I'll go back to school, you know, and there's a lot of us like that. And
Well, it's an effective way to reset. I think that sometimes, and I'll just bring this up because we are in a bizarre economic situation in 2025, and a lot of people are going through non-voluntary job changes. And it's a tough job market and things like that. And one of the ways to work through it, which I think that people sometimes give themselves a very hard time, they can be hard on themselves for making this choice, but it's an effective way to do it, to go back to school and retool and relaunch through that proven system. I don't know if that will always work because I'm not a fortune teller, but it is definitely something that I think that people should probably be more gentle on themselves about. A lot of people do it. One of the thought patterns that people knock themselves around with this, which is partially accurate, school's not really designed for people who are no longer in their 20s, like the hours and things like that. So that's definitely a challenge, but there are lots and lots of people who do it. And so we should be more enthusiastic about the opportunity that goes that. So you're in this training, you love school, you're learning
I
something
do.
new, but and one of the things you're doing, I think, is you're working with clients directly with supervision, like as an academic pursuit. I think that's the way that's going. And something begins to happen, and you work out that you don't actually want to do this. Walk us through and connect the dots between what happens, because you're very excited, you're enthusiastic, you have a mentor in this field, and then you come to the conclusion that you've gone down the wrong path.
So it took a few years for me to sort of understand that, but so you one trains for I think I trained for almost a year before I saw patients one on one. Before that, I did things like what's called an intake. If you ever go to any sort of psychotherapy clinic or even to a medical clinic, someone will come up and get your name and what's going on with you and kind of assess you briefly. And then, you know, you'll go to see the other person, you know, the people you need to see. And I was doing intakes. So that was my way in to start to get comfortable with people. And then I was training, I was taking classes about psychology and about the view of, mental health from this particular viewpoint from psychoanalytic training. Now, psychoanalysis gets its roots in Sigmund Freud. Freud believed essentially that all people, we have these drives that we're born with. Everybody, inherent things. And from his view and a lot of psychoanalysis, those drives are only aggressive or sexual. That's what we are inherently born with. And so there was that view. And then there was a view in my training, and it's throughout any psychotherapy, the need for diagnosis. Now, that's necessary, quote unquote, for mainly for the insurance companies, but also to sort of, if we can diagnose what's quote unquote wrong with you, then we can prescribe a treatment plan. So after a year, I started to see patients. I saw patients, I guess, 2 or 3 years then. And you know, the way it works in this sort of training, it's still in any sort of psychoclinical setting, you see your patients and then you review them with your supervisor who helps you understand and, you know, see what the person's saying and what they mean. And I started to feel the diagnosis was really not, it wasn't right. I didn't feel it was compassionate. I didn't feel that it was necessary. This isn't to say, Amy, that people don't have serious problems. You know, everybody, you know, people have anxiety, people have delusions. That is true, and it's deep suffering. But I didn't feel that it was right to say, oh, well, you have an anxiety disorder or you are this X, you're a depressive. Right. I just, that really started to bother me. And then I started to notice that nearly all the patients that I saw, they had a belief in themselves that was not correct. You know, they would tell me what was wrong with them. They would tell me, you know, why can't I hold down a job? What's wrong with me? Why do I keep picking the wrong, you know, women? What's wrong with me? And I felt like that storyline wasn't right, because I began to feel that there was nothing wrong with anybody. And I don't, again, I don't mean that doesn't mean we all have troubles. I just never felt like, well, anybody's really broken.
Right.
You know, we just have our stuff and we have to, you know, take care of it and understand it. And finally, my supervisor, I had a patient who I really felt a lot for. She was quite young and she was in graduate school. And she had divulged to me a childhood trauma that she'd never told anyone before. And, you know, that was a big deal for her. And I guess I was seeing her 6 months, 8 months. And she said out of the blue and so sincerely, she said, "Do you love me?" And like, it, she really, she loved me, you know. Yeah. And I paused and I said, "Yes. You know, I do love you." And then when I was talking with my supervisor said, "Well, when I see clients, patients, and they ask me that, I say to them, the way I'm going to love you is to help you understand you. Or the way I'm going to love you is to, you know, understand you and reflect that back to you." And although I could see that that was useful, I just began to feel like, you know what, Amy, the way I'm going to love you is to love you. Like, it doesn't need to be so obscured. Or so you can see the seeds were planted, and I was feeling very unsure that this was something I wanted to continue. I also did not feel that people were only born inherently with like aggression and sexual drives. That's clearly not true. If you've been with an infant, they have a deep need to connect. We all do.
Well, so the closed captions were playing on my face when you were talking about Freud, only because, not because I'm an expert, but because there are, in 2025, 2026, there are jokes about, I mean, this was a long time ago. He had some ideas about humanity that are kind of hilarious in a modern lens. And I don't mean that critically, but it was a time. It was a time when cocaine was considered a healthy product that would enhance the process. Today we still call that illegal in most of the United States. So, all right. So you talked about a lot of things that I think that we can go a little bit deeper on. You talked about the conflict of the industrial, these are my words here. So let's see if they make any sense. Sort of the industrial medical complex in the United States that requires that in order to get treatment through insurance, things have to be classified. And the terminology they use in some medical offices for this is actually medical coding, where, you know, if you have a broken bone, you know, it's like, here's the code for that. We put it on the form. Your insurance is going to pay for an X-ray and a cast and physical therapy and that kind of stuff. And so it can be very helpful, right, to get a diagnosis. You go to the doctor and they're like, you have strep throat and here's what we're going to do to make it go away. But what I think I hear you saying is that where you were running into it is that with some of these mental health situations, I mean, is this who you are as forever, or is this something you're experiencing? Like, are you a broken bone or do you have a broken bone? Am I on the right path?
Very much so. Very much so. And, I just think it's in terms of mental health, you can describe symptoms, right? I'm really suffering. I'm having panic attacks. I have lots of self-criticism. All of that could be very true. Does that mean, oh, I have a narcissistic personality disorder? I don't know. I don't know, but I don't even think it's all that useful.
Right.
In terms of treatment, in terms of how one would approach someone.
Right. I mean, sometimes I think there's probably nuance there, right? Like sometimes it probably is very helpful. And other times it's just a data point that, you know, maybe isn't. And I think that everybody in the audience and you and I have enough life experience to know that sometimes these people get diagnoses wrong, but usually not with a broken bone. But actually, sometimes even then, I know a friend who was in an accident and went to the hospital and they said, oh, your ribs are fine. And then they went back several days later and there's still an extreme pain. And then they're like, oh, you have all these broken ribs. Mm-hmm. It was too soon, or I don't remember what the situation is. So I think there's benefit, and also everything is not always so black and white. But in your instance, it sounds like you were feeling was you weren't connected deeply to embracing this particular thing that you would then represent it and make it your next phase of livelihood. And one of the things that you've also touched base on is some of the therapeutic modalities have very strong rules about connection and relationships between the therapist and the patient. And I've talked to other people who've struggled with this, because what you were describing is that there's separation. And is it Freud that was the one who came up with the whole projection? Like, you, of course the patient is going to, you know, fall in love with their doctor. Like, is that where that came from, or was it somewhere else?
Well, he said that, and others did.
Others too.
He would have said it from a Oedipal view.
Right, because,
but, you
yes,
know,
right.
Later would say, yes, that happens. You know, it's a relationship.
And it can be very intense and require an enormous amount of trust. You're giving your deepest, darkest, most inner thoughts to somebody who is there to help you, which is the most fabulous kind of intimacy between two people, right? To trust somebody with your darkest secrets and have them say, thank you, let's work on that, you know?
Yeah.
That feels great. So I can understand that. But you were like, I don't know if this is the professional relationship that I would have with people.
Yeah, I just felt, I mean, let me be clear. There are many ways to do psychotherapy. I have been helped by amazing psychotherapists. And the one thing, when they do research on what's effective in psychotherapy, is there are all different modalities and types, but the single most effective is the relationship between the therapist and the patient, or the client, however you want to say it. And so that relationship was what became important to me. And as you're saying, I didn't feel I could do that authentically within the framework of my training.
Yeah, there's another interview of a guest that I did, and she had a different degree, but she had a similar reality that the professional, some of the things that came with the profession didn't align with her, the way she wanted to conduct herself. And so it's definitely a reality of some professions, and I have no judgment about it, but I think I've heard about it before. So you've put all this time in, so you've got a lot of education at this point. You've got a bachelor's degree, you've got a master's degree, you've got work experience, you're significantly invested in time in working towards this degree. You decide that this is maybe not the thing you want to do. What do your friends and family begin to say to you when you're like, oh, I don't know?
It was amazing, Amy. I can still remember, like, people close to me. My closest, oldest friend, who I've known since childhood, she's like a sister. She was really supportive. She said, okay, Kimmy, it's not for you. Great. And nearly everyone else I was close to at the time were saying things like, well, you sure? You only have, you know, maybe a year and a half left. You'll be licensed. Several people said to me, wow, you wasted all that time.
Wow, there's a message in that wording,
right?
right? Yeah.
Right. Oh, you invested so much to throw it away. It seems like a waste. I heard that a lot. And yet I really felt like I cannot be authentic to myself and continue this, So I did. In order to be fair to the patients I was seeing, I withdrew from the program, and it was over a period of about 4 months, to make sure that those connections were okay as they transferred to other people, and I wrapped things up. And then I was just in this sort of, it felt like a real limbo.
Were you still working at the, okay, so
I
you're still working
to
at the
work
marketing
there.
firm. Okay. All right.
Yep.
So,
yep.
But you're out of school, you're in limbo. And so you mentioned, as we were talking, that you, when you were younger, you had some personal experience with, I think, anxiety and panic. And then I think in the intake form for the interview, did you begin to experience panic attacks again at this time while you were in limbo, or do I misunderstand that?
I did a little bit later.
Okay.
So I withdrew from the program. And at the time, it was this very sort of liminal time. I didn't really know what the future would look like. And I had a lot of doubt that I did the right thing or not. I also felt like, that person that said, like, what a waste.
Yeah.
I was thinking that too. Like, well, what I did, I learned a lot. You really learn how to be with someone, how to listen in such a important way, and with a very special attention. I learned all of that, and I guess I'm not going to use it. I don't know. So one thing I did, because it had been like 4 years of constant working, you know what it's like.
Yeah.
You work part-time and you go to school, and everybody listening, I'm sure you've been through this, it was so busy. So it was kind of nice just to kind of relax for a couple years. I was in a relationship with someone that had began soon, right about the time my program was ending. And, I was just saying, okay, I'm just going to relax. I'm just going to relax. I'm going to see what happens here.
Okay.
And I guess a few years went by, and I'm not sure there was one catalyst, but many. I broke up with that man, or we broke up, and I had a cat who fell out of a 5-story window.
Oh my goodness, that's dramatic.
I know. It was very dramatic. It was very New York.
Didn't land
New York,
on his feet?
He did. He survived.
He did. Holy
yes,
cow.
They call it high-rise syndrome here.
Really?
Yes.
Well, there's that thing where
that
cats
common.
Always land on their feet. And I was like, from five
yes.
stories? Oh my gosh. Wow.
Oh my God. So he fell. I mean, he was injured. It was a very New York story. I had to grab him, jump in a taxi. The taxi driver knows where the 24-hour vet hospital
emergency
is.
Vet.
Yeah, exactly. He was in an oxygen cage for a few days. So these
I'm
things
sure that
happen.
Was very, very economical. Like
oh,
cheap,
oh,
super
yes.
cheap.
So cheap here in New York. yeah, so these, small losses, and one day I started to have panic attacks, and the panic attacks would start at night. I became really fearful of being near the windows.
Maybe from a cat, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And just a lot, I think a lot of old trauma was arising, from my childhood and things like that. And, Amy, I could tell you just why it was happening. I had a real understanding of the causes and how it was manifesting and how it related to when I was young and how it felt so similar and all of those things. And I didn't have any tools to work with it.
So that is a really interesting thing. So for so probably most of the people listening have had their own experiences with anxiety. Maybe they've also had panic attacks. They are pretty ubiquitous and common. They're awful. I've never met anybody who's like, yay, let's go have a panic attack and think we're dying. And I think this is really interesting that you were living through it and able to apply your academic understanding of it, but also the academic understanding wasn't helpful in moving through the moment.
Correct. Yeah, it was not.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. The treatment I had had was very conventional. It was just talk therapy, which was helpful. I don't even mean to say just. It was really helpful.
But not in the middle of the night when you're in a panic.
Not in the middle of the night when you're in a panic. And when, you know, really it's like wild thoughts is what happens. You know, your body starts to react to these thoughts and it becomes a, you know, real cycle of suffering.
Yeah.
And so that led me to find people who might be able to help me with my mind and my panic. And that was meditation and mindfulness.
And you found this through Buddhism, I think.
Well, I
or no.
found it first. I have been, doing yoga for years for exercise.
Okay. You know?
And in my yoga classes, often, not always, Amy, but often the teacher would lead us at the end in a little meditation. So I had like an understanding that that might be helpful. And then in New York City, there were lots of places where you could learn to meditate. You could learn mindfulness. And I started to go. And many of them were Buddhist.
Yeah. I'm not a meditation expert, but I do think that the Buddhists are sort of known as kind of the best.
Yeah, they really were. Like if you want to know about how to deal with your own mind, they are experts in it. Yeah. They have a system. They have a framework. They have lots of practices.
Yes.
And they're effective. And so this led me into, you know, it led me into where I feel like I always belonged. You know, I mentioned several times I wasn't sure where I was going to go. You know, I wanted to be a writer and then I'm in HR and then I'm this and I'm just not so sure. And this I felt so sure about, that I was in the right place for myself and with the right people, with the right teachings, you know. And so I started to learn and practice with a couple different Buddhist centers in the city, and then, you know, started to meet people in that world and went on retreats. You know, that's part of meditation practice, is to, you know, be able to go away for a week and just practice and be still for, you know, a period of time. And it was such a surprise to me. I hadn't thought I would wind up in the Buddhist world at all. That wasn't in my background. It wasn't, none of my friends were involved, you know, the people I'd known for years. I now, of course, have many friends in that world. And it was such a, just a wonderful surprise. And it was so useful to me. It really saved me in the same way that I said that my first therapist in my 20s, you know, really helped me and saved me in a certain way. The same thing happened with this practice. And so, Amy, that just, I knew that was the direction I was going to go in. Within a year or two, I was training to be a meditation teacher and a mindfulness teacher, instructor. And since that time, that's what I've devoted my life to. I stayed in the human resources for a year or two more there. And then I did leave and have found my way in this world, in this discipline. And it's, in some ways, it seems so obvious that it would be my path. You know, I meet old friends and they say, oh, yeah, of course, you're inclined to that, you know. But for me, it's still sort of a surprise. And I really feel so grateful, you know, that I kind of, my suffering led me to it.
That is, I love this story in so many ways. So I want to ask your opinion about something, and just your opinion and your experience. I'm not an expert on this, but I'm curious about it. Because I think that today, in many Western sort of psychotherapy circles, you would find practitioners who would include mindfulness and breath work and maybe even meditation in what are very, you know, in a very, you know, non-Buddhist environment. You might find this in, you know, your allergist's office or, you know, in the, training for first responders when they're talking about how to calm down and things like that. These things feel to me like they have crossed over a lot of places where they weren't. But I don't think that that was the way it was a couple decades ago. I think there was more separation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's wonderful to see it be more in the culture. When I first started practicing Buddhism and training in it, people would always say to me, like family, my dad said something like, yes, I know someone else that does yoga. Everybody thought it was the same. But Amy, no one says that anymore. People do understand, you know, people will say, oh, I know what mindfulness is. My therapist does it. Yeah. My child's school does that.
Yes.
So it has much because it's a useful tool.
Yeah, my kids had, there was in middle school, they did a mindful moment and they all just mocked it. But at the same time as I would say to them, I was like, no, I believe in it. They're like, well, with you, we get it, but we don't like it when it's on the loudspeaker at school. I was like, whatever, you know, that's totally reasonable. Okay. So the practice of meditation and mindfulness, it helps you with your actual body state and the panic attacks in your own experience. This becomes such a pivotal shift in your own life that it becomes your mission and your practice. Like you shift away from working in somebody else's office. You do not go into physics, although, you know, all of it, I'm sure, comes all together. And as you said, you go all the way in and you train in this, and this is now what you do as a profession. How long have you been doing this?
I came to it about 15 years ago, and I started teaching and really on this path, I guess, about 12 years ago.
Oh, so quite a long time. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite self-help books that I think it's just really good. It's not new, but by a long shot, is Tara Brach. Radical Acceptance, right? Yep. And she is a Buddhist practitioner, I believe, and instructor. And where I said, I was like, you know, I think the Buddhists take this very seriously. Whenever I will listen to her podcast, I will listen to things like that. But I always tell people when I talk to people who maybe have not done it, I'm like, listen, there's a whole level of meditation with the practitioners that are Buddhists, and you may not get there right away. Like, so you know, start with what feels good. And then, you know, just know that they are on a whole other level. But one of the things you mentioned was that you sent that feeling of belonging. And one of the things that I've heard just over the years, just anecdotally, and I may be way off base, that's kind of one of the, I think of that as one of the tenets of the Buddhist theology, the acceptance of the situation, the belonging, like the story of under the tree and allowing. Is that, am I right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and what you're pointing to is I had a sense of belonging to the group, to the community, okay, who were very open. And I developed a sense of belonging to myself in the sense of there isn't anything wrong with me, Amy. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Sometimes I get mixed up. Sometimes I'm angry. Sometimes I'm anxious.
Yeah.
And the relationship is very different. You know, to have a sense that I'm okay. And
yeah,
I can breathe through this, and I don't, you know what? I don't have to react out of it. I can get really mad and sit with it, with it, and say, okay, I have anger. It's all
and,
right.
And you know what? I see you doing it. And I just want to allow for all the people that are hearing that you have a lot of practice and it sometimes is not that easy. And one of the examples that I picked up at one point, it's like, you know, it's like allowing the rain to fall on you and just, you know, be with the discomfort. There is another side to that, which is if you are not so enlightened in the Buddhist culture, that maybe you feel the rain and you acknowledge it and you go inside because you are not yet there.
Beautifully said. Yes.
You are not, you got out of the rain.
Absolutely. And what we're saying in the Buddhist view is we're not saying go sit in the rain and be uncomfortable.
Well, some people, it sounds like that is what they're saying. Sometimes
No, what we're saying is, you know what, Amy? There are many things in your life that will be unavoidably hard.
Yes. Okay.
You know, my mom got sick. That is going to happen. I lost a job. That is going to happen. I fought with my child. That is going to happen. How do I relate to that?
Yeah. No, that,
You know?
and I think that's very powerful. So a friend of mine who's, who this is, she, her name is Hunter. Years ago, we did this swim, an ocean swim. And at the time that we did the swim, the waters were just totally full of jellyfish. It was like it was a dramatic, very dramatic event. And I run into her after the event and I was like, how is your swim? And she had just won an award that was these jellyfish earrings, because everybody knew that there were so many jellyfish. And she's very much into acceptance and allowance. And she's like, you know, I'm swimming along and I'm in their space and I just am allowing that and it's part of the experience. And I was like, all right, I've known you for a long time, Hunter, and I will accept this from you. But also it was really painful. I wanted it to end.
Beautiful.
And
yes.
She was like,
yes.
She was like, true, very true. But I was like, okay. It's so funny.
Yes, because that's important. You know, there are misrepresentations and misunderstandings sometimes about the practice and what's the point of it. The point is not for you or me to walk around with happy, happy feelings all the time. And I'm just going to meditate till I feel great. That is not the point. The
Yeah.
point is each of us in our humanness have all kinds of experiences and all kinds of feelings. And so how can we soften and be with them? How
Right.
can we
And
say, yeah,
yeah. And
the
sometimes
jellyfish
in
are
the
here.
Jellyfish are here. And that's an anecdote that's like really trivial. But in the human experience, we all have moments where it's not jellyfish. It's hard stuff. It's, you know, losing jobs, needing homes, you know, the very nature of the human experience. People get sick, you know, the transition, big life transitions, including the one that none of us escape, watching the people we love pass and die. Those are hard things. Those are hard things. So I am glad that you reframed that and that you took the time to walk that path with me, because you did explain the benefits so very, very much. One of the things that I love, and we'll wrap this up and we'll talk about your special offer and those things. One of the things that I truly love about being alive in 2025 and 2026 is the sort of weird and synchronous connections between very modern science and ideas that have been around for thousands of years. So, you know, now, you know, so Buddhism is not a new thing. It didn't come out in the, you know, in the 2000s. But it had been a tradition and a practice that had been studied and practiced outside of the existence of, you know, functional MRI machines. But now you've got all these researchers who are able to like take these wild pictures of people's brains while they're meditating and actually turn around things that are like, yeah, this does change the way our brains work. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's amazing. You know, for people that I'm close to in the Buddhist world, you know, we will see a new study and say, oh, look, science caught up to Buddhism again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of them that's to me been so important, almost everyone that works with me, Amy, almost every person I've known, it feels there's something wrong with them.
Yeah.
And we have a culture that's all set up for that, right? Self-help, get better, be improved, you know, all these things. And there's a sense like, well, I'm not really a good person. I'm a bad person.
Right.
Or I could be better, or guilt, shame, whatever. Anyway, Buddhism says no, that's the opposite, actually, that all of us have an inherent sense of wanting to connect, of wanting to treat ourselves and the world with wisdom and kindness. So, you know, that's posited. And then there's a researcher, his name is Dr. Richard Davidson. He is in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a longtime student of the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
And he now he has the Center for Healthy Minds. You can see that on the website for anybody listening. And where he's devoted his life to seeing, well, what practices, what ways can people do to connect with this? And is it even true?
Okay.
And what he found in his early studies was, indeed, all of us are born with capacity for compassion. Compassion being, you know, to have empathy for our own and others' suffering.
Right. Because the people sometimes mix up compassion with just being nice to somebody, but built into that word is that you are sharing the suffering of the other person. That's like the, yeah. That's the, yeah.
Yeah. And so he found that it's there. It's there in all of us. And it's very similar to the ability to speak a language. It needs to be fostered through the environment. So it's one of those things like, you know, I wouldn't know English unless people spoke to me as an infant, right?
Right.
And I wouldn't know compassion unless they demonstrated that to me. And
sure.
So what I'm saying to you and to everybody listening, no matter how old you are, you can start to develop this skill because you have the inherent ability, the capacity. Otherwise, you know, it's sort of like, oh, so-and-so is so loving. How did they get that way? I'm not like that.
Right.
You are.
Yeah. And I think that really touches on one of the roots to the reason, the idea behind this show, right, is the difference between academically knowing something and having somebody tell you something and hearing or watching from somebody who has walked the path, right? So I have like a lot of single line jokes about it. It's like, you know, you talk to the guy who's going to do the root canal and he's like, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of discomfort. If you talk to the patient who just had it done, you're going to get a completely different story of how to walk through it because they're going to share their experience and maybe offer you like some, you know, ask for the pain reliever, some practical experience. And it makes sense. And there's also, you know, I think when we look around, there is a societal culture that we all have, which is that some people call this the implied deal of the American society that is currently sort of not showing up, which is that if we follow the steps that we're supposed to do, and we, you know, listen to our parents and we do our homework and we get the degree and we buy the house, that happiness shows up just because we followed those steps. And then when it doesn't, we turn it around on ourselves as clearly I've done something wrong and there's something wrong with me. And then we pursue help in finding somebody who will give us a diagnosis of what's the thing that's wrong with me. And I use that very loosely, the diagnosis, because it could be go back to school, get a divorce, you know, any of those things, not necessarily a medical thing. But that does seem to be a common thread that is in the opposite, like sort of oppositionally, like a reflection of, you know, the inherent goodness and nature and humanness of people and just accepting and allowing and learning those skills that walk through it. So I think there's a lot there and it's really good. Okay, so back on track. Tell everybody a little bit about your business and how they can reach you, and then I'll share a special offer that you have for the audience.
Amy, so I am a meditation teacher. My work is focused on developing a sense of self-compassion and a steady mind. I've written several books on meditation. The most recent is called Happy Relationships, and you can find those at any bookstore. I teach classes, and what I did wind up doing is all of that training that I had as a psychoanalyst, I also now use it with my students. And I teach a lot of people privately and individually how to use these practices, you know, to connect with themselves in a kinder and wiser way.
Yeah, So
you can find me. I have a very robust Substack newsletter. And when I say robust, it has a lot of audio meditations. And we have a community that we practice together twice a month on the Zoom. And the offer is for a paid membership for a month to my newsletter, which includes all of these audio archives and also our half-hour meditation that we do twice a month in the evening, or at least East Coast time evening, that I would love for you to join us and see if it's for you.
That is a spectacular offer. So free one-month subscription to the weekly Substack newsletter, Meditation with Heart. And the way people can redeem that is that you're going to email Kim at meditationwithheart.com and with the subject line. And the details of how to collect that are in the show notes. Wherever you're listening or watching the show, the easiest way always to get these special offers is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community, because then I zap it right into your email box and you can just copy and paste or click. So thank you very, very much, Kimberly, for that very generous offer. I hope that people take you up on it. I really, really do. And so if you're ready, are you ready for the final three questions?
Let's do it, Amy.
Let's do it. Can you name a song that you love so much that when you hear it, you are maybe probably going to sing it out loud, whether you're at home, in your car, or even if it's the soundtrack playing at the grocery store while you're shopping?
Yes, I am going to name the old, old Four Seasons song, "You're Just Too Good to Be True,"
okay,
which I have loved since childhood, and it was played at my wedding. And I will probably stand up and dance a little too when the tempo goes up in the middle of the song.
Love it. I do love it when I'm in the grocery store and people are singing in the aisles and they're like, so just, it cracks me up. It does crack me up. I also love it when you're driving, you stop at a traffic light and you look at the people in other cars and they're singing along.
Isn't
I love that,
great?
Too. I do. I love it. I do. All right. So you're a writer. Do you enjoy reading? And if so, do you want to share with us a book that you've read or listened to, like, because audiobooks, right? Everybody does that now too, that you think that me and the audience might consider for ourselves?
Well, I have to recommend a book called Real Love by a teacher named Sharon Salzberg. She is actually one of my main meditation teachers, and she is really inspiring and really practical and down to earth. So it's really just, actually, I'm going to correct that. It's Real Happiness.
Real Happiness.
Real
okay.
Happiness.
All right.
And it's a great primer for learning meditation, and also for just simple ways to connect with your humanness.
Very nice. Happiness can be elusive, I think. I think as a child, I thought that happiness was going to be, and I generally have a pretty annoyingly optimistic, happy sort of outlook. But, it's like happiness feels easier as a child than it does sometimes as an adult, is what I'll say. So that's my own personal experience. It's like, this should be easier. So that's that. Okay. So question number three. If I walked into your kitchen and boldly opened the refrigerator, which I reflected on as I was writing this question, I think would be a super rude and impolite thing to do, but let's go with it for the question. If I opened your refrigerator today, what would I find inside?
Okay, you would find, let me see, I'm imagining my refrigerator right now. You would find three bottles of Coca-Cola that I put in there for my dear friend Michael, who recently visited me.
Okay.
You would find some yogurt, plain yogurt. I love it. You would find cheddar cheese and a lot of leftovers. There's leftover lentils. There's leftover raviolis from a few days ago. And probably some leftovers in the back that need to be tossed.
As any fridge probably has. That's it. Kimberly Brown, thank you so much for being an amazing guest today on the show.
Oh, Amy, this was such a treat. Well, how nice to meet you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected,
that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.